From WHQR Public Media in Wilmington, North Carolina, this is Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. Coronavirus edition number 3. Since last week, Governor Roy Cooper has handed down a statewide stay-at-home order. Some counties and municipalities have gone even further with stay-at-home guidance. For example, New Hanover County has defined specific businesses that must close, such as auto dealerships and hotels and motels. When there are discrepancies between the state and local order, the more restrictive version takes precedence. New Hanover County also ends its curbside library service starting today, April 1st. Brunswick County libraries have been closed since March 20th. Zoom meetings are the order of the day for many people working from home and for students engaging with teachers. Neighborhoods are creating games for kids, teddy bear hunts, in which residents place stuffed bears in trees, windows, and on front porches for kids to count. The number of positive coronavirus cases in North Carolina grows daily, but the numbers we hear do not reflect the actual number of cases. State epidemiologist Zach Moore says, with an incubation period of up to 14 days, stay-at-home orders and social distancing won't appear to pay off for at least 2 weeks. In fact, says Moore, the bad news is that North Carolina is at the beginning of its pandemic crisis. On this edition of Coastline, segments 2 and 3 will be live. We'll take your questions, and we want to hear your stories on this Wednesday, April 1st. Audrey Hart of the New Hanover Disaster Coalition and Beth Gaglione of the Food Bank will join us, and we encourage you to send your emails now to coastline@whqr.org. We can't take your phone calls because, again, we're broadcasting from my home, but we can take emails again in segments 2 and 3. This first segment features two conversations, both pre-recorded, with local public school officials. First up, the newly installed acting superintendent of New Hanover County Public Schools. Dr. Del Byrne, superintendent of New Hanover County Schools, welcome to Coastline.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Now, in this case, you knew that you were coming into a district that was challenged by what seemed like an inordinate number of assault allegations. Now we're facing a pandemic, which brings with it a whole new set of challenges. What's your first priority right now, and what are you grappling with?
As always, the first priority is safety for students and staff. Students are safe. They're in their homes now. We're focusing on safety of staff. The rules are becoming interesting at this point because there are pieces that are in play now that have not been in play before with respect to leave for employees. And we're dealing with remote work. This district is not a one-to-one district, meaning that there's one device, laptop, or tablet for each student, nor has the district addressed remote learning to a great degree or focused heavily on blended learning and flipped classrooms where you're using devices. We're ramping up all of those things. We are deploying devices. We started yesterday working through the high schools. We'll work our way down through the elementary schools. So there are a lot of challenges that are coming here, but the first priority is safety.
How are you thinking about the kids who were already more likely to fall through the cracks? Are they even more at risk now? And what options are out there for them?
Having remote learning opportunities for students is a challenge in the best of cases. For students who have fewer resources, who might not have access, it is a greater challenge. And so we're doing everything we can to work not only online to provide support. We're going to continue using paper pencil packets that will go home. We're having to focus on both. Teachers are doing what teachers always do. They're doing their best to care for all of their students. And so they're calling them on the phone. They're connecting remotely, trying to stay in touch with the students as well as provide instruction. For the first 2 weeks, we did not focus on new learning. We focused on supplemental learning, reinforcing concepts that had already been taught at that grade level. This week, we are training teachers and supporting them with the platforms that will be used for online remote learning. We're developing the materials that we'll send home for students to work with, and developing what a typical daily schedule would look like for a teacher in a classroom. For the students that don't have as much support or as many resources, again, we're doing what we can. We're aware that there are some inequities, and regrettably, this situation in some ways amplifies inequities because of the need for access and the availability of other resources for families. Knowing that, we're doing the best we can, but also keeping an eye toward when we return to a brick-and-mortar, face-to-face student-teacher interaction, what we'll do to provide additional support and remediation for students that perhaps didn't get as much out of this experience as they might. But this is forcing us to relook at how we approach teaching and learning.
Can you give me an example of something that has been a happy discovery out of this that you've thought, we should bring this forward?
Well, the blended classroom where teachers are using the devices for more than an online worksheet or something that students can search by using. Problem-based learning, where you're actually using devices and the internet to take a problem and to research it, develop a solution, develop a presentation. Those are the kind of things that I'm looking for. Problem-based learning is exactly what we should be doing. That's what the work experience is for adults. That's how we use the internet.
What does this do to the search for a permanent superintendent? Is that person still expected to start in the fall of this year?
They may need to extend certain elements of the search a bit, depending on the response that they have. I would expect that they'll follow the timeline, and it will take a couple of months, but I cannot see a reason that they should not have a great candidate pool. This is a strong district, and I recognize that there have been challenges recently, and there have been some very, very bad things that have happened. There have been some bad actors that have done some things that are just hard to even speak of. But the district is full of outstanding teachers. Before we no longer had the students, I visited almost half of the schools and have been incredibly impressed with the teachers. So there's amazing instructional staff.
Dr. Del Burns, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. Appreciate the opportunity.
You're listening to Coastline. In the next segment, we'll hear from representatives of the New Hanover Disaster Coalition and the Food Bank of Central and Eastern North Carolina. That conversation will be live on this Wednesday, April 1st, and we'd love to hear from you with your questions, your challenges, what you're noticing is new for you. We can't take phone calls since I'm broadcasting from home, but we can take emails at coastline@whqr.org. This next conversation I recorded with Dr. Jerry Oates of Brunswick County Schools. Dr. Jerry Oates, welcome to Coastline.
Thank you so much. Glad to be here with you.
First of all, do you know roughly what the percentage of the student body is that qualifies for free and reduced lunch in Brunswick County?
With Title I schools, I mean, that simply means that 40% of the students would qualify for free and reduced lunch. So all of our elementary schools are Title I. I would say around 40%.
Governor Cooper talked a lot about, before he shut down schools, the considerations that came into play, like making sure kids who didn't have access to healthy meals would have it. How much assistance are you getting from the state on this front?
Well, as far as the state, keep in mind that child nutrition is a function of federal funding. As far as the state, right now we have not gotten any assistance, but we have been allowed to use our buses to transport meals if necessary, and we just started that today.
How is that going so far?
As you know, we've opened our high schools, our traditional high schools, as feeding sites since the closure started. And we're offering breakfast and lunch for all of the students who need it. What we've started today is for those folks who don't have transportation or a means to get to those feeding sites, we have asked that they submit their need, their address, so we can put a route together and deliver the meals directly to the bus routes of the students that have the need.
Are you seeing the demand that you expected for this? Is anything about this surprising you so far?
Not at all. I was expecting what we have, and I expect it to increase. as we continue to go through this closure.
And why do you expect it to increase?
Well, the longer we stay out and having folks aware of the service that we're offering, I'm just expecting there to be more folks that would take advantage of it. Some folks have not yet submitted addresses if they don't have transportation. I think that's going to become a piece of the increase. And just the mere fact of having children at home now that typically would eat breakfast or lunch at schools, families may be inclined to take advantage of what's being offered at these feeding sites.
Is it possible that some folks might be reluctant to reach out and say, hey, I need home delivery if a big yellow school bus is going to pull up?
Yeah, that has been a consideration as well. But we want to make sure, regardless of the situation, that our students are getting the meals to them. And I know that may be some folks' situation, a stigma that may be attached. But in this time, there shouldn't be any stigma attached, just as there wasn't during the time of when we had hurricanes. You know, we were giving food and everything out to everyone who needed it, who wanted it. And this is the same situation.
Now, when we talk about virtual learning and what kids are doing at home to keep up with their schoolwork, how are you seeing that situation evolving? I know this is kind of a learning curve for everybody here.
It's been a learning curve. I can't commend enough our teachers, how they have sprang into action to ensure the continuity of instruction. I was just looking at some information today about the participation of students, and we're having large numbers of students who are participating in all of the activities that their teachers are putting, whether it's on online videos, using Zoom meetings, any format that has been put before them. Students are really taking advantage of it, and that's definitely encouraging to see.
What about the families where the parents may not be as invested in the students' education, or they may not have the hardware that they need to participate in some of these opportunities?
What the school system has done since March 16th, actually prior, once we got notification that we possibly would be closing, our instructional technology team and media coordinators and folks in the school systems have deployed all of our devices, many of our devices, for students who needed them. Any students that did not have the hardware, any type of computer or laptop or any electronic device, we supplied them to take home. If they did not have internet resources, we have given them information. I think Spectrum was one company that was giving free internet. We've given them that information to sign up for that.
Superintendent Jerry Oates, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for the opportunity.
You're listening to Coastline. When we come back from this break, we'll be live with representatives from the New Hanover Disaster Coalition and the Food Bank of Central and Eastern North Carolina. And we want to hear from you on this Wednesday, April 1st. What's your biggest challenge? What worries you? How are you staying connected to the community? Tell us about your experience or ask a question by sending an email to coastline@whqr.org. Remember, we can't take phone calls, but we can take emails. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn for Coastline, Coronavirus Week 3. Listening to Coastline Coronavirus Edition Number 3. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. We're live now on this Wednesday, April 1st, once again with Technical Director Ken Campbell at the station, me broadcasting from home, financial help on the way from state and federal governments for families and small businesses. Governor Roy Cooper just recently announced an executive order that bars utilities from shutting off service for those who can't pay, but there are other needs and people who some local leaders fear might be forgotten or left to fend for themselves. Joining me now remotely to help us understand some of the challenges we might not always hear about are two of these local folks. Beth Gaglione is the branch director for the Food Bank of Central and Eastern North Carolina in Wilmington. Beth Gaglione, welcome to Coastline.
Hi, Rachel. Thanks for having me.
Audrey Hart is executive director of the New Hanover Disaster Coalition. Audrey Hart, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you.
If you have a question for either of them, or you just want to share your experience, whether struggles or a happy discovery, send us an email at coastline@whqr.org. We can only take emails live on this Wednesday, April 1st. Again, that's coastline@whqr.org. Audrey Hart of New Hanover Disaster Coalition, where are the biggest needs right now in the Cape Fear region?
I might sound a little bit snarky, but I'm not sure there's a lack of need within the county. I think the biggest population right now are especially the higher risk for being positive for COVID-19 or a higher risk. So the medically fragile, people with disabilities, people who have an autoimmune disease or anything like that, is definitely a higher need, especially with that fear being there of catching it and not knowing the turnout. But food insecurity, housing insecurity, financial insecurity. So there's not really one specific population, but rather all of it, right? Businesses and individuals.
Beth Gaglione of the Food Bank, have you seen a change in demand for your services in response to the coronavirus pandemic?
We absolutely have. And the couple of ways that we're measuring that is, as you well know, we serve as a resource for food for what we call our partner agencies. We have almost 100 of them in a four-county area. And we have seen their coming in to access food at the food bank increase pretty substantially. In addition to that, when we reach out to those sites that are distributing food, you know, they're on the front lines every day of emergency food distribution, and they are seeing between a 50% and 100% increase in the number of people that come to them. So, you know, not dissimilar, I think, from our own feelings of food insecurity and wanting to visit the grocery store as often as we can and feel like we have what we need in our homes. People with fewer resources, you know, have the same level of concern about having what they need to.
And so, Beth, are you saying that some of the increased demand then might just be psychological?
Well, I don't know that I'm necessarily saying that, but I think it could play a role. We're all being told to stay at home, and so people want to have what they need there for the period of time that they can stay in and be safe and not expose themselves. I do think the demand is real. I think that people's resources are being spread. I have to think that some of what we're seeing too is people who are new to the emergency food line, people who work in hospitality to make a living. We know how that has been impacted. So I think when we can go back 6 months from now and look like we did after Florence, I think that we will find that there are people who are new to the emergency food lines that have never accessed them before.
Mm-hmm. Audrey Hart of the New Hanover Disaster Coalition. This is a relatively new organization. Help us understand how and why it started.
Sure. So the Disaster Coalition formed pretty soon after Hurricane Florence, when faith leaders, nonprofit leaders, and just advocates within the community saw that efforts were being duplicated and not coordinated, whether it was to providing food or donations and things like that. So they kind of all came together when it was socially acceptable to do so, right? They came around the table and figured out, you know what, let's work together on this and make sure that we're serving the full community. And so from there, the coalition kind of grew to just only faith leaders and nonprofit leaders to know we have community advocates, we have the businesses involved, we have the city and the county involved, we have a lot of different entities involved within the coalition, to really make sure that we're looking at the community as a whole.
How did you get involved with it?
So today is 1 year of me being in this role. And so I just saw the opportunity. My sister works in disaster recovery and sent me the job posting. I decided to throw my hat in the ring, and for some reason, and I'm very, very lucky to have been chosen for this role.
And I want to ask about the resource gaps that naturally occur in a community like this. I mean, one of the things that we reported on at WHQR in the immediate aftermath of Hurricane Florence was there seemed to be geographic pockets that were kind of that had people with no means of getting out, no real means of communication, and were kind of wandering the streets looking for some help. Are those some of the gaps that you address, and what are you seeing now?
Yeah, I mean, those are definitely some of the gaps that we're trying to address. I don't pretend to know where all of those gaps are or where those service gaps are either, but I'm always open to hearing where those service gaps are. I think I almost always end conversations or start conversations with, what do you need from me or the coalition? So knowing where those gaps are and how to communicate with that community is key, right? Asking the subject matter experts, whether it's working with the homeless population or working with kids within schools or working with the senior center or anything like that, is just asking, how can I better serve this population? Finding that out or find out what it is that their immediate needs are or what do they foresee coming up as a need. So I think that's, if people start asking those harder questions with maybe not an easy solution of, well, let's just go to the grocery store and buy the supplies, but I think that's where the conversation starts.
You're listening to Coastline. Coronavirus restrictions are challenging enough to live with. So how are local nonprofits dealing with them? With us today, Beth Gaglione of the Food Bank of Central and Eastern North Carolina. She's branch director in Wilmington. And Audrey Hart, executive director of the New Hanover Disaster Coalition. They're answering your questions during the live discussion on Wednesday, April 1st. And you can ask a question or tell us about your own experience via email only at coastline@whqr.org. And this note, I'm not sure if this is something either of you can answer, but it's worth reading. This person says, I understand the enormous work involved in getting food out to the students and families who rely on schools to get meals when those schools are closed. I know there are sites for pickup, and also volunteers are packing and driving out meals. I wonder, this person writes, if New Hanover County Schools has considered using school buses and drivers to distribute these much-needed meals and food items. I imagine it isn't possible for some families to get to the sites, and school bus drivers are not working at this time. The drivers would drive the same routes they're familiar with, could have a few volunteers on board to help. Seems like a straightforward way to get food to families using a system already in place. And of course, we heard Superintendent Jerry Oates of Brunswick County talk about this method. Is this something that either of you have heard is up for discussion in New Hanover County?
So my understanding, Rachel, is that New Hanover County is delivering food into sites where they don't have the food being prepared, so dropping it off at schools. For example, Carolina Beach Elementary School was not on the list of their original sites. There was nothing on the island, and that has changed. They have, with the help of some really dynamic volunteers in our community, put together a route where volunteers had been picking up at the schools and delivering to individuals. Just hordes of volunteers were volunteering to do that work. And my understanding is that the school district has taken their addresses and has put a new route together, and they are using bus drivers. They are also using bus drivers in Pender as well.
Mm-hmm. And that, of course, is Beth Gaglione of the Food Bank. And Beth, tell us, you've had to kind of adjust the way you operate during this coronavirus pandemic. What are some of the changes that you've had to make?
So on top of our normal operations of serving the community, the Food Bank has distributed approximately 3,000 additional boxes containing 20 meals per box in response to COVID. The boxes are what we are hearing is most helpful to the community right now, providing more meals to sustain people during this time. So, you know, we're so grateful to have Audrey as a part of our community now. And she talked about how, you know, after Florence, during Florence, you know, there were some duplication of services and we weren't working in as coordinated a fashion as we could. And she's absolutely right. So we are working to coordinate our efforts with disaster relief partners, with school districts, with entities like the New Hanover County Meals on Wheels. We certainly don't want to duplicate any efforts, but we also want to try to identify what some of those gaps are that might exist. We've heard, just like the previous question that came in, there are a lot of resources focused on kids right now. They are an extremely vulnerable population, and I don't want to take anything away from the groups who are doing that work. It's so important. But we also have to remember that families and seniors are in need as well. And so we continue to work with partners across our service area to find innovative ways to serve our most vulnerable neighbors, including our seniors. And we have changed our focus a bit to dry goods and shelf-stable items that we can ensure people will be able to have in their home for a more extended period of time. I will mention, too, and this also relates to the previous call, that we have been able to stand up some of our summer food service programs in some counties that we work in where perhaps the response from the school district has not been as deep, I guess, into the community. And so some of these feeding programs that are traditionally only open in the summer have started to open and feed kids as well. So I do have to emphasize that one of the things we are having to do more now than we have had to do in the past is we are having to purchase food in greater amounts than we probably ever have had to. And I think that Audrey can also echo that this is probably happening within other organizations as well. You know, this is a need that is a worldwide need. This is not a hurricane that hit the coast. And so food banks across the country are struggling to keep their inventory stable. And that means having to raise funds to buy food. And I'm sure that's not unique to the food bank. That's, you know, all of us having to make sure that we have what we need.
What is your supply line? Where does your food usually come from?
So about, and this is speaking specifically to the Wilmington Food Bank, about 50% of what we distribute on an average day comes from donations from grocery stores. They are extraordinarily generous to provide us with food that they know won't move in a timely fashion within their stores. We have seen a significant decrease in food coming from the grocery store, and that's not because they're too busy to supply it or they just don't have it, right? So we're not seeing the excess come because their food is, they're having trouble keeping food on the shelves themselves, although I've seen a considerable change in that in the last week. And I don't think we need to be concerned about the supply chain coming into our grocery stores. We do traditionally purchase from some of the same vendors that grocery stores purchase from. So food distributors that have food banks as their customers and grocery stores as their customers. We're a part of a national network of food banks called Feeding America, and they do a considerable amount of food sourcing from us too. And I can't forget to also mention our local farmers. They are amazing contributors to the food bank. We're not seeking out as much perishable food as we normally do, but we're certainly not turning it away because we all need to keep eating fresh, healthy food to stay well.
Sure. Audrey Hart, you told our producer about over 20,000 items that people in the community have donated to just to folks in the region and to NHRMC. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah. So I think it was 2 weeks ago now, we decided to start a donation drop-off location in coordination with NHRMC and the county and the Disaster Coalition, just so that we can seek out donations for the specific masks, whether they were the ear loop masks or the N95 or higher, some reusable, disposable gowns and gloves, and just basic medical equipment that our public health workers are going to need to be able to address COVID-19 within the community. So all of those items have been donated from individuals within our community. Some people drove in from different towns within the county and even in the surrounding counties as well. So just everybody partnering and putting in what it is that they had on stock, whether it was from doing lawn care, and that's just the type of mask that they had, or businesses that said, you know what, we're out of business right now, we're going to be able to get them when we reopen. But doctors, nurses, CNAs, and everybody on the front line does need access to this equipment.
You're listening to Coastline. Audrey Hart of the New Hanover Disaster Coalition and Beth Gaglione of the Food Bank are with us today. We're going to take a short break. And when we come back, we'll hear more from listeners. It's also the last segment, so you have just a few minutes left to get your own question or comment in during the live Wednesday discussion. We can't take calls, but we want to hear from you via email at coastline@whqr.org. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn for Coastline. Listening to Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. Today, it's a look at how nonprofits are adjusting in the Cape Fear region as they face the challenges of stay-at-home orders by state and local governments. The way they deal with volunteers and the people they serve is now far more complicated due to COVID-19. Two local leaders are with us today to unpack some of these challenges. Audrey Hart is executive director of the New Hanover Disaster Coalition. Beth Gaglione is the branch director for the Food Bank of Central in Eastern North Carolina in Wilmington. We are live on this Wednesday, April 1st. If you have questions, you can email us at coastline@whqr.org. We'd also just love to hear how you're coping. What's an average day like for you? Have you learned anything new about yourself, your family members? What's the hardest part? Again, you can tell us about it during the live Wednesday discussion at coastline@whqr.org. It's the last segment, so just a few minutes left to get your question or comment in. And I want to go to an email from Shalane, who's a nurse practitioner. She writes, please ask your guests about clothing resources for people in our community. I work at a healthcare center downtown, and yesterday, she says, we had a man come to our clinic with just a short sleeve shirt on. It was rather chilly outside, and he asked for some resources where he could get more appropriate clothing. Unfortunately, she says, we didn't know where to send him. Audrey Hart, is that something you can answer for Shalane?
So typically when we get requests like this, my normal method is just calling a lot of our partners and figuring out who still has those resources. So that's definitely something that that is not uncommon, right, to find that almost like a random need, but a very real need. So I can definitely touch base with a couple of our partners and see what they have on hand and what they can provide.
How is the COVID-19 pandemic affecting shelters? places where people go to have a roof over their heads at night and some warmth?
So for shelters, it's changing operations quite a bit, especially with capacity and screening and things like that. So a lot of shelters are trying to maintain that social distancing of 6 feet between beds, or the CDC recommends doing head to toe. So if you can't provide 6 feet, do just switch the beds, flip the bed so that it's head to toe. We're working with a lot of our partners to figure out what their capacity is, where their service gaps are, and everything like that. So it's definitely changing, and it's a very new world for us out here.
Yeah, and how does this affect the volunteer corps as well in terms of keeping those folks safe who have direct contact with the people that they're providing services for?
Yeah, I think for the volunteering, I think it's really, really new for all of us, right? We're almost used to responding to hurricanes, and we're used to standing up and I'm saying, hey, I need help, and then 15 people show up. And right now, that's almost the opposite of what we need. Mm-hmm. We need folks to stay home, but folks still need volunteer opportunities filled. So we're monitoring how and providing guidance for partners to maintain the social distancing, but not social isolation, and figuring out what kind of volunteer needs can be either on one-on-one or in pairs, and working with them on providing kind of a new volunteer orientation before they even sign up or get out in the field and help.
That's right. At the food bank, we've really had to change the way that we encourage our volunteers to come. We've had to place age limits, unfortunately, in order to, you know, encourage that those who are in those vulnerable populations, you know, don't feel like the need is so overwhelming that they feel obligated to come and serve us. We've seen a lot of new volunteers, a lot of college students come and try to help while they have a little more time, but we're taking much smaller groups of individuals, and we are encouraging them to stay 6 feet apart while they're volunteering. One of the things that your caller brings up about the clothing reminded me that one of the things I wanted to share was that at the food bank, we have a tool on our website called the Food Finder. And, you know, the worst thing possible for someone who doesn't want to leave their home is that they go out seeking a resource only to find out that the doors are closed temporarily. So I really want to encourage people that are listening who may need help, or those who are trying to help individuals who need help, to check out that Food Finder tool. It's at foodbankcenc.org/find help. Our staff at the food bank is working very hard to keep that updated on a daily basis, so that no one does find themselves venturing out for a resource that's not there. I had an agency pop to mind when your caller mentioned clothing needs, and I was going to mention it, and then I realized they are temporarily closed. And so that is a reality that we're trying to work with as well, is organizations having to postpone services for lack of volunteers mostly.
And Beth Gaglione of the food bank, this is kind of a challenging nut to crack, isn't it? Because we're hearing at the governor's daily media briefings the call for volunteers, especially retired medical workers. You could assume that retired medical workers often means people in that older age range that are the folks who are at higher risk for severe symptoms of coronavirus. How do you navigate that?
Yeah, Audrey can second this as well. And that is, when we look around within our social service agencies and who is volunteering within them, it is most dominantly, populated by individuals in our community who are retired. I do have to give, though, props to so many of our feeding organizations like Mother Hubbard's Cupboard and First Fruit Ministries, Nourish NC. They're doing such a great job modifying how they normally do their work. They're looking for alternative ways to keep individuals safe that come to access, not just people who need the services, but their volunteers as well. And I was speaking with one of my coworkers yesterday, and she said, Beth, when people come looking for emergency food, their experience will be really different than anything they've experienced before. But it's just in an effort to keep people safe. So our partners in the community are nimble, and they're just trying to be as flexible as they can to think about the safety of the people who need services, and their volunteers who see themselves as essential to the work that is happening in the community.
We have an email from Juliet in Hempstead. She writes, I live alone and I'm working from home as I've been doing for the past several years. What's different now is I have no visitors or physical contact with family or the opportunity to go out and do something to break the routine. Thinking in terms of safe at home rather than stuck at home makes me feel much better. She writes, that helps me see this time as an opportunity for all of us to step back from the rat race, to reconnect with ourselves and with what really matters, and to allow the earth to settle into a more natural state without the incessant and often damaging comings and goings of its human inhabitants. And Jesse writes, are volunteers still able to help at the food bank? If so, what social distancing practices have you enacted?
Yeah, so that's a great question. We are still allowing volunteers to come into our space. I don't want to use the word encourage because I don't want someone to feel like the need is so great that they would come out even though they feel unsafe doing so. So I have said to folks, if you do feel the call to come and you feel safe, volunteers volunteering for any social service agency in the state of North Carolina is exempt from the stay-at-home order, so they can come. They are considered essential. The food bank has a website where people can register, and I ask that they do that in advance. It's foodbankcenc.org/volunteer. We are only accepting groups of less than 10 every day, and we put them 6 feet apart, encourage them, remind them regularly to stay that way. They have gloves that they're using when they're sorting through food, and I think they're doing a great job keeping each other safe.
So often when people share a crisis experience, it brings out the best parts of people. And for me, it's just been interesting to observe that every day, from elected officials, from people on social media, news people now, TV anchors, we keep hearing the line, we're in this together. It's a line that gets said in public almost every day. And it's a well-used line. It was familiar before the coronavirus. But do either of you, Audrey Hart or Beth Gaglione, what kind of meaning do you see this taking on now? And are you hearing it with fresh ears?
So for the Disaster Coalition, our slogan, so to say, is back to better together, because nobody can do this alone, right? It takes everybody to band together at a distance. So for the Disaster Coalition and for myself personally, I am kind of hearing it with new ears, so to say, just because I think it's resonating with people right now that we are all in this together, and no one person is going to have the perfect solution for everything, but it's going to take listening to one another to be able to find our new normal.
Yeah. We have a message.
Go ahead, Beth. I was just going to say that last time that Audrey and I talked, you know, we kept referring to the next storm, which you just assume is going to be the next hurricane, right? And it's interesting to think of when we were sitting down and talking that we never could have expected that the next storm was going to look the way that it looks. At the food bank, you know, one of the things that we keep saying to one another is that we're in this for the long haul, and we're thankful that the community trusts us to be their partner in this effort. But because none of us really know how long things will last and how long the need will be increased, we're just having to stay on top of funds and food that we can gather from people who believe in our mission, keep tailoring our operation to the changes I mean, that's really all that we can do. But it is comforting to know that those who support us are willing to stick with us for the long haul.
And Laurel writes about her small business, Coastal Kids Therapy, and we're hearing this. All kinds of businesses are trying to either rescale to accommodate different models that can operate during the stay-at-home orders, and others are just having to close. And she says, we're a private outpatient pediatric occupational therapy practice serving about 140 patients weekly. Have five other occupational therapists in my practice and an administrative assistant. They decided to close March 20th to be safe, and they make money solely on insurance claims when they see clients. So they are trying to change the model to continue seeing clients via telehealth, and that's something that wasn't previously covered, but now due to the pandemic, Medicaid and other insurance companies are covering it. They've officially launched OT telehealth this week, and it's been an amazing experience. Therapists have risen to the occasion despite fears and doubts about how this would work out for kids on the autism spectrum and with a variety of other special needs. What kinds of people are you now seeing that have needs as a result of the pandemic, Audrey Hart, that maybe you haven't seen before coming for help?
Definitely that mental health piece right now. I think a lot of folks are still recovering from past storms and past damages, whether that was physically, they're still not in their homes or apartments, or mentally. Every time there's a thunderstorm and uncertainty, that kind of just brings everything back, right? So as far as mental health and spiritual needs right now, that's a big need. But folks mm-hmm. that probably are newer to finding out what the Disaster Coalition is and who we are mm-hmm. and what this coalition is all about, probably the service industry, folks that are the essential businesses and business owners and things like that, how are we going to keep our doors open? The statistics per FEMA for businesses to stay open during this time after a hurricane is very low, so much less after having a pandemic and a hurricane within 2 years is very difficult. So folks are really concerned about that because they maybe just got back on their feet, or they're not yet back on their feet from Hurricane Florence. That was, I think, 19 months ago. And now we're dealing with a new financial insecurity disaster and economic that's going to be totally different.
Yeah, and we're also looking down the barrel of April with Easter, Ramadan, Passover, with a stay-at-home order. So what mm-hmm. kinds of spiritual resources or mental health resources can folks find and still stay at home?
Sure. So for spiritual leaders, there's a couple of different groups that are out there to help one another as pastors, as leaders, and as reverends to just join in together and really go through this together, because sometimes the leaders need a support as well, and that's with One Christian Network. Warrior Family Ministry also has a call in. You can set your appointment and things like that, and a chaplain will be with you and be able to pray with you if that's your desire, right? Not everybody copes in the same way, so there's definitely outlets for the spiritual needs. But for mental health, the Trillium 24-hour line and also the disaster hotline are two great resources.
Okay, and we will post some of those on our website with this post as well. That's this edition of Coastline. Audrey Hart of the New Hanover Disaster Coalition, Beth Gaglione of the Food Bank, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Rachel.
Thank you.
Thanks also to Superintendents Jerry Oates and Del Burns. Coastline's production team is led by Rachel Keith and includes Ken Campbell, Doc Jardin, and Marissa Castrino. Coastline is a production of WHQR Public Media. If you missed part of this episode, look for it at WHQR.org, get the podcast, or find it on the HQR app. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.